For our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners, your North Carolina Reading Service presents the following program. It's the Indie Week. John Fetterson here with you to read this week's issue, which is dated April the 3rd of 2025. Loads of articles again this week. The new Indie Week format includes outside articles being reprinted, and therefore my folio gets thicker and thicker for a 58-minute broadcast. I'm not able to read or even excerpt a few of these articles. I'll start with governmental related materials first. Seven questions about the Durham Public Schools budget is Article 1. It's officially budget season at public schools in Durham. Last week, Superintendent Anthony Lewis unveiled his first budget draft, which lays out rough amounts and priorities before he and the school board decide on final line item accounts to ask the county commission to fund. Here are seven questions you might be asking about the budget as the draft inches toward a county commission vote that's scheduled to come up in June. How much money does DPS get from the county? There are charts here from fiscal years, local appropriation, capital outlay appropriations, and the graphs and charts, which I can't relate to you. But I can say that 24-5 DPS budget totaled around $700 million. Of that $700, the county provided about 50%. Through direct funding, 30%, and capital outlay, 20%, that was largely funded by bonds. The budget included a historic increase in funding, giving the schools $27 million more from the county. At the time, the county government worried about the sustainability of such an increase and, in February, warned DPS administration to restrain their expectations this year. The superintendent's budget this year asks for a perhaps more palatable $16 million increase over last year. How is that impacted by federal cuts? The short answer, no one knows the full effect, but the district is already losing out on some funds thanks to President Trump's orders. He recently signed an executive order to all but dismantle the federal Department of Education. The department, as far as K through 12 schools are concerned, mainly funnels money to districts through programs under Title I and IDEA, that's the Disabilities Education Act. In 24-5, the district received about $43 million, or 6% of its overall funding, from the federal government. At the board's March 27th meeting, Lewis said DPS is also losing out on DREAM grant funding, which funded a collaboration with UNC Chapel Hill, quote, to recruit and train teachers from underrepresented groups to work in high-needs schools. That $4.8 million program was just a piece of the $600 million cut to similar programs. Indy has already reported on how that cut is already hitting the neighboring Wake County. How will district support its bus drivers? That district is still dealing with that prolonged transportation crisis caused by a bus driver shortage. The budget draft includes about $377,000 to provide each driver with a $200 monthly local supplement. In light of the series of school cancellations due to snow this year, the chief financial officer, Jeremy Teeter, said that such a supplement could help drivers have some stream of income, even if weather prevents them from working. Board member Natalie Beyer asked how much it would cost the district to raise the bus driver's starting salary to $20 an hour. Teeter said he would have more information for that April work session about the possible pay compression impact of that increase. Driver's starting salary is currently $18.86 an hour. which Bayer has previously compared to Grow Triangles, $20.60. DPS drivers only usually work for 10 months a year. What's up with that $7 million shortfall? DPS actually had a roughly $34 million shortfall for 24-5, as Teeter announced in January. There was no one single reason for the gap between expected and actual expenditures this year, as the district spent more than expected on payroll, charter schools, child nutrition, and several other areas. Lewis's interim predecessor, Kathy Moore, had already recommended withholding 15% from the operating budget, which reduced the shortfall to about $7 million. In February, the district announced plans to use some of the philanthropist Mackenzie Scott's 2022 $18 million donation to fill most of that hole. At the recent meeting, Tito told board members that he expects to maintain the levels set by that 15% cut for both school and central department budgets. The district has also announced a temporary hiring freeze excluding bus drivers and exceptional children staff. The district is also going through its annual allotment process, which is a routine look at every school's enrollment and current projected course registration numbers. In neighboring Chapel Hill, that process led to an outcry last month when the district told some teachers they wouldn't have their contracts renewed. Next, how much money do charter schools take from DPS? The superintendent's budget draft would increase funding for charter schools by $2 million. That's due to a North Carolina law that requires local districts to transfer, quote, an amount equal per pupil share of public school funding to charter schools, that is, the dollars follow the student. Teeter said that added up to about $43 million of local taxpayer money passed through DPS to charter schools in the 24-5 budget, as the county has over 8,200 students enrolled in charter schools. What's next for the budget? And as we said, on April 9, the board will hold a public hearing to get community feedback. After that meeting, the board will meet publicly with the Durham Association of Educators, that majority union, which is currently hammering out a recognition agreement with the superintendent. Many of the DAE's stated priorities are budget-focused, including classified pay compression, full restoration of master's pay, extra pay for extra duties, and a multi-year plan for certified, supplement, and classified pay increases. Well, the board will then parse that budget on April 10th, before a final vote, currently set for April 24, to send the request to the County Commission. Bonus question. How much does a tuba cost? The budget lists one-time costs, including two concert tubas at $10,000 each. Also from Durham, Justin Laidlaw writes, what to know about Durham County's recent property tax revaluation? In January, the county's tax administration office completed its two-year reappraisal process, which reassessed the property values for all of the roughly 126,000 parcels within Durham County. Notices for the new valuations started going out to residents at the start of last month, March. The assessed value of the property and the county tax rate determine what a property owner's annual tax bill is. The last property valuation in Durham County was in 2019, when the median sale price for a house was approximately $239,000. By the end of last year, that figure had grown to $416,000. State statute requires all counties to conduct a reappraisal at least once every 8 years, but because of the rapidly shifting housing market in the Triangle and neighboring counties. Durham County moved to a four-year schedule, which would allow residents to adapt to a more gradual change in property value and the accompanying tax bill. Keir Doyle, the county's tax administrator, is a Durham native who started working in real estate in 2005, and he says the new valuations come as a surprise to everyone, including him. He said, "I remember when some of these properties were $80,000, and I saw them going from 80 to 160, and from 160 to $335,000. In some neighborhoods, the price jump is staggering." During a presentation in February to the Durham County Commissioners, Doyle shared examples of home values that made significant leaps since that appraisal in 2019. A home that sold in South Durham jumped from $325,000 in 2018 to $560,000 6 years later. In Watts Hillendale, a West Durham neighborhood, a home skyrocketed 136%, $300,000 in 2018, $710,000 last May. And in East Durham, just a 10-minute walk from the city center, a home sold for $160,000 in 2020, and a colossal $600,000 just 1 year later, a 273% increase. Doyle told Indy, "Now we're seeing stuff I would never have imagined when I was growing up here." Where is all this demand from Durham properties coming from? Near the onset of the 2010s, Durham saw a spike in new residents as the renaissance in the Bull City started taking shape. The relatively low cost of living compared to larger or similarly sized cities, a flourishing food scene, high-paying tech jobs, and a proximity to other amenities like state parks, beach, and an international airport made Durham attractive to people from across the country. Doyle also says the climate change could be impacting migration patterns. Raging fires to the west, elongated and more brutal winters to the north, and hurricanes in the deep south are pushing Americans to plant roots in a different class of city. Doyle says, "I believe what we've seen over the last 10 years is just people being a lot more observant and paying more attention to what's going on in the world. You've got a lot of people that just got smart about migrating to an area where we get all four seasons." We're talking about the greater Piedmont, Wake County, Durham County, Chatham, and Orange counties. Since 2019, Durham County has added an estimated 7,000 to 8,000 new parcels. They include residential and commercial properties, vacant land, and some tax-exempt properties like schools and religious institutions. Without annexing land from neighboring counties or green land, new parcels were created by rezoning vacant lots or sprawling properties that only included a few structures and turning them into subdivisions packed with townhomes and apartments, each with their own parcel ID. With the majority of property values likely going up due to this appraisal, the county board could look to balance the burden on taxpayers by lowering the county tax rate. The county has a significantly larger tax base due to the rise in population and parcel count. In 2024, Durham County tax rate was almost 80 cents per $100. That's the second highest in the Triangle region after Orange County. Property owners who also live within Durham city limits paid an additional 60 cents per $100 in city property taxes for this fiscal year. Nida Alam, a Durham County Commission chair, also suggested at the February presentation that the county start publishing more detailed, itemized tax bills so residents will get a more transparent understanding of how their tax dollars are being spent. Some Durham County residents suffered sticker shock after receiving their updated valuation in the mail last month. For recent homebuyers, the shock of a new valuation is tempered by the fact that the value is fresh in their mind and the bill is likely divided up and bundled into their monthly mortgage payment. The challenge, says Doyle, is for long-time homecomers who have paid off their homes and don't have a mortgage. These folks skew older, and some are on fixed incomes. Those residents tend to get their tax bill, often thousands of dollars all at once, and they have a short window to pay it off. And Doyle says, that's why I spent the last year trying to do aggressive community outreach, because the number one issue is not about the buyers. It's the people who have owned their home for 20 years and paid it off. They don't have a mortgage. Those are the people we want to get to and speak to and make sure they are aware of what's going on. Folks can appeal the valuation with the Board of Equalization and Review. These applications are due by June the 16th, before the county commissioners establish the new tax rate for the next fiscal year. Doyle recommends residents take action on their appeals based on the valuation and not on their tax bill. He says if they're considering appealing, they need to appeal based on the tax value. Do not wait for your tax bill. Once you get your tax bill, it's too late. You'll have to wait till next year. Don't wait to see what your bill is to appeal. If you're going to appeal, you need to appeal based on your value, not your bill. Most residents appeal in the first year, Doyle says, and then submissions taper off. In 2019, the county received 7,000 appeals. It's about 5.5%, but by 2024, there were only 80. The state considers 10% of appeals for Durham, that's 12,600, as an acceptable measure for an effective reappraisal. Still, tackling a large volume of appeals with limited bandwidth can be daunting for Doyle's department, so the fewer, the better. And he says, we want to make sure we're able to keep the standard of customer service high while doing that, and it gets harder the more appeals you have. So it's a good operating number if we can stay around 7,000 or less. But considering this is a historic real estate market, and the market dictates the tax value. If the market was out of the world, unfortunately the tax rates were. So because of that, I would expect us to have a historic amount of appeals. I don't want it, but it's to be expected. Next to Raleigh, an article on April the 1st. Why did Raleigh's Planning Commission accept $1.5 million in lieu of promised affordable housing units at Union Station? Should Go Triangle and the developer Hoffman and Associates be allowed to pay $1.5 million into Raleigh's affordable housing fund instead of including affordable units in the high-rise apartment complex they're building next to Union Station, as they originally offered? Last week, a majority of members of the Raleigh Planning Commission said yes. Although the 4-2 vote in the developer's favor is only a recommendation, the City Council gets the final say. It illustrates the tension between the City of Raleigh's stated housing goals and the political and financial realities affecting its ability to realize them. In 2019, the City approved Go Triangle and Hoffman's request to rezone 1.74 acres of Go Triangle's owned land at 200 Southwest Street for high-rise mixed-use development. This was prime real estate in Raleigh's up-and-coming warehouse district. Union Station had just opened next door, and the city was already in a housing crunch at the time. The partners planned to build two towers containing retail space, hotel, and hundreds of apartments. Embedded in the rezoning was a condition that 10% of the apartments be priced affordably for households earning 80% of area median income or less. Over the subsequent 6 years the pandemic hit, construction costs spiked and the site sat empty. GoTriangle and Hoffman revised their development plans down to a single 23-story tower with retail and 385 apartments. Then, last week, they asked the Planning Commission to amend the zoning conditions to allow them to contribute to the Affordable Housing Fund rather than include any affordable units in the development. Specifically, they offered to pay $40,000 times 10% of the total housing units in the building, about $1.5 million to the city, in lieu of including 39 affordable units as planned. Ordinarily, a developer in Raleigh is not obligated to build any affordable housing or pay any amount of money into the city's affordable housing fund. But since GoTriangle and Hoffman voluntarily added the affordable housing condition to their rezoning request, the city has leverage to hold them to that commitment or not. During last week's Planning Commission meeting, Hoffman representative John Florian argued that high-rise construction costs have gone up and rents have dropped since 2019, creating unfavorable conditions for development that make it impossible to include affordable housing in this building. He told the commissioners, "It is an extremely, extremely challenging financial environment right now. We don't see any point in the future where you can get enough rent on the non-affordable units to cover that deficit in the affordable units to make that financially feasible. Maintaining the current conditions would render the project unviable," he elaborated in an email to Indy. "If the rezoning request is not approved, the site would likely remain undeveloped for an extended period or be limited to a less financially challenging, lower-density use that does not align with the city's growth and housing needs." GoTriangle deferred to Florian and Hoffman after Indy sent the agency a request for comment. The two planning commissioners who voted against GoTriangle and Hoffman's request questioned whether a $40,000 payment in lieu of each unit was sufficient. Commissioner Reeves Peeler said the amount was, quote, "not adequate for a downtown high-rise given the housing inequality, homelessness, and general unaffordability of Raleigh." Commissioner Tololope Omokaye called the payment in lieu proposal as an escape route for the developers and questioned whether an extra $1.5 million would meaningfully impact housing production elsewhere in the city. Commissioner Dwight Otwell, who ultimately supported the request, says he was conflicted about his vote because GoTriangle is a public entity and the development is next to a transit station, factors that potentially increase the city's responsibility to deliver affordable housing. Florian's response: "The public-private nature of the project does not exempt it from fundamental financial realities." And he presented the commissioners with a binary choice: accept the $1.5 million payment in lieu or say goodbye to this downtown development opportunity. He framed the first option as fair and data-driven. But is it? According to Florian, GoTriangle and Hoffman landed on $40,000 per unit payment based on, quote, "past city guidance on affordability contributions intended to reflect the cost of replacing a market rate unit with an affordable unit elsewhere." Matthew Clem, a senior planner for the city, told Indy via email that Raleigh does not have a policy that encourages or specifies a monetary contribution for affordable housing production. "If a developer volunteers to make a contribution," Clem wrote, "the money goes into, quote, a discretionary fund that council can use to support a wide range of affordable housing programs or projects." Like Raleigh, most cities in North Carolina have not created policies for payments in lieu. Even the ones who have policies on paper, like Chapel Hill, have struggled to successfully implement them. Further afield, in places where mandatory inclusionary zoning is unambiguously legal, cities like Portland, Oregon, and Minneapolis would likely require a significantly larger contribution from developers. In Portland, developers can choose to build a certain amount of affordable housing on site or pay a fee of $27 per residential square foot. Constructing 385 market-rate apartments with footprints of, say, 700 square feet, which is below the average for a one-bedroom in Raleigh, would trigger a $7.8 million payment to the city. In Minneapolis, where the payment in lieu fee is $22 per square foot, the city could charge the developers about $6 million. Raleigh isn't Portland or Minneapolis. It can't enact a mandatory inclusionary zoning policy without running afoul of the General Assembly. But in this rare instance, city leaders get to decide whether Go Triangle and Hoffman's proposal is a fair trade-off. The day after the Planning Commission made its decision, Raleigh Mayor Janet Cowell gave her first State of the City address. In it, she spelled out her vision for increasing the city's housing stock. Quote, "We need mixed-income, mixed-use housing integrated with transit." The 200 Southwest Street development is a test case for that vision. When the City Council hears Go Triangle and Hoffman's request in the coming weeks, it can opt to accept the $1.5 million payment in lieu, double down on the original condition, or if it doesn't like either choice, try to negotiate with the developer. Well, let's continue with the homelessness issue, at least in Raleigh, and we'll sort of move into a library-related issue. How two Wake County libraries are navigating this homelessness crisis. At 8:30 a.m., a heavy-set man stands outside the Richard B. Harrison Library waiting for the glass doors to open. It's frigid, a near-freezing day, but John is prepared. "You got to have these," he says, cheerfully pulling out a pair of mittens stashed in the pocket of his hoodie. "And don't forget these," pulling up the hem of his jeans to show off long johns. The outfit is topped with a bright orange and blue beanie. John's already been standing in the cold for about 45 minutes after dropping off his phone at a nearby barber shop to charge. If he manages to scrounge up a couple of dollars, he'll get himself a black and mild before settling down in front of one of the library's computers to look for a job, he says. He says, "I'm not an entry-level person. I have certain skills. My main thing is warehouse operations like Amazon, DHL. I'm supervisory material." In addition to looking for a job and building his resume, John is also looking for nonprofits that help pay rent and utilities, he says. It's not unusual for people in need, especially those who are unhoused, to show up at the library in the early hours. Richard B. Harrison and Oberlin Regional, the two biggest libraries in downtown Raleigh, are warm, clean spaces where people experiencing homelessness can linger without a consequence. Kathy Johnson, executive director of local nonprofit Oak City Cares, says living with homelessness can be chaotic, loud, and traumatizing. And she says the library is a safe, quiet space where people can access the internet to connect with family or look for jobs. It also offers time alone, she adds. "We all take for granted that when you just don't want to be around people, you go to your room and you close the door." Libraries can provide some of that solitude and space for people. On the open, bright second floor of Oberlin Regional, people from all walks of life are sitting quietly, some reading, some working, and some just being. In one corner, a man in a gray beanie silently bops along to the music in his earbuds as he plays online chess. Across the floor, at a white desk, a young woman with long red hair types rapidly on a laptop. Meanwhile, Rob and his friend, a woman bundled up in layers of fleece, sitting next to a metal walker, are just chilling, he says. They come here nearly every day, mostly to stay out of the cold or inclement weather. On this February morning, the sky is gray and the rain has been drizzling down for the last few hours. Her and I don't have nowhere to go, Rob says. It's somewhere to stay dry. Across the country, homelessness is surging. From 2023 to 24, the number of people experiencing homelessness increased by 18%, according to the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Numbers in Raleigh mirror that trend, Johnson affirms. In 2024, Oak City Cares served about 6,000 people, four times the number it served just 2 years earlier. During Wake County's annual point-in-time count last January, volunteers spoke with 992 people who were unsheltered during the night, providing a snapshot of the extent of homelessness in and outside of Raleigh. Data from this year's count is not available yet. The wealth gap in North Carolina and across the country is on the minds of many, including John. In early February, he's troubled by the news of recent union battles between local Amazon workers and leadership. He says they, the Amazon workers, are already on strike. Jeff Bezos don't want to pay them, and he got all them billions of dollars and got money still coming in hand over fist. Him and Elon Musk, John continues, the guy's almost worth about $500 billion. Can you imagine just waking up in the morning, your house is as big as this library, you got 3-4 private jets? That's a whole lot for one person. On the other hand, on the other end of the oligarch spectrum are people at risk of eviction or experiencing homelessness. During the week, Oak City Cares acts as a hub where people can come in to fulfill their, quote, basic needs, like doing laundry, taking a shower, picking up mail. While libraries can't provide all the services the nonprofit does, they do have public computers and areas where people can charge their cell phones. Johnson says it's another one of those things you might take for granted if you aren't really familiar with experiencing homelessness, but your cell phone is your lifeline, and being able to charge it really is important. Equally important is the fact that in a city where resources are limited, public libraries are numerous and usually easily accessible. Harrison has a bus stop right outside its main entrance, and Oberlin Regional is also near a bus stop on Route 16. Robert Lambert, manager of Oberlin, says, we are an urban branch, and we have all the rewards and challenges that entails. We have 6 universities in our service area, and we have at least as many shelters. This year, in a major step forward, social workers in training have the option to embed in various libraries as part of a UNC Pembroke internship program, says Deputy Library Director Ann Burlingame. She's hoping the initiative, if the libraries are chosen by interns, may boost the library's efforts to connect people to resources, including government aid programs that can be complicated to navigate. While the main causes of homelessness are the cost and availability of housing, not mental illness or addiction, there is still some overlap. Experiencing homelessness can worsen mental health, lead to substance abuse, and distance people from necessary care. Social workers could help librarians develop the skills they need to help or de-escalate disruptive behavior. In 2024, Raleigh police responded to 17 calls for service inside Oberlin Regional, including for welfare checks, general assistance, disturbances, threats, and trespassing, which the library only resorts to after repeated offenses, says Lambert. Quote, if someone is violating the policy against excessive or disruptive noise or behavior, they may be asked to leave. Likewise, if someone is clearly inebriated or under the influence of drugs, they will be escorted out. A trespass charge, we may move to that, says Lambert. That means a ban of 1 year, although the decision can be appealed. Often, if the ban is related to alcohol addiction, quote, people get themselves together and they get a second chance. I've seen that time and time again. There are people who will probably be in today who I know are sober now. The library also bans smoking, vaping, and the misuse of restrooms, including use for personal bathing and grooming, and requires appropriate dress, including shoes and shirt. But none of these rules apply only to a specific population, says Lambert. There are people who are homeless who want a place to sit and eat, and we can do a lot, but we're not a cafeteria. But that applies equally to that high schooler who just came in from Chick-fil-A. Still, some of these rules may disproportionately affect people experiencing homelessness, like the ban on sleeping. Library staff are not equipped to run a day shelter, but it's also difficult to turn away someone who only got a few hours of sleep on the sidewalk last night. Sitting at Oberlin Regional, Rob says that one of his responsibilities is to keep his friend awake. He said she stayed at the food hall overnight. They let her sit there last night because of the weather. I was a block away from her. I have a tarp with me, so I covered myself with that tarp, and that was that. There has to be a balance between public access and security, says Burlingame. Security officers from Allied Universal are stationed at Oberlin Regional and Richard Harrison, but the effort is to build relationships, not crack down on behavior. Burlingame adds that social workers may also help bridge that gap. So we don't just assume the way to handle this situation is to call security. While there's still progress to be made, Wake County Libraries have done a great job of working with people experiencing homelessness, says Johnson, speaking from an outside perspective. Quote, when you're unhoused, there can be a lot of shame and distrust. You don't really want to share with everybody what's going on with you and your situation. There's a lot of judgment. In Wake County, they've been fantastic. Librarians are often the first point of contact for people who come in looking for help, whether it's to find a book or a place to sleep. When a staff member is on the front desk, they essentially act as, quote, an emergency room nurse, says Lambert. Quote, you have to triage every different person. People will come in with a need, and the ability to articulate that need is not as intuitive as you may think it is. We listen to the person first, and we may ask clarifying questions so that we know the answer we're providing is actually addressing the need they have, which is not always the same as whatever it is they just expressed. There's no one script, just like there's no one type of person who comes into the library, says Lambert. Everyone comes from different circumstances, including experiences of homelessness. And he says, we're trained not to make assumptions, so before we actually listen to people, we have to withdraw our own biases so we're capable of hearing them, so we're not imposing our own worldview onto the person in front of us. In recent years, Wake County Library managers also received additional training on how to help people dealing with housing insecurity, says Burlingame. librarians toured Oak City Cares and heard about the experiences of people dealing with homelessness and the volunteers who helped them on a day-to-day basis. Quote, "The thing that they, the county, taught us is to focus on the person, not on their situation. They are our library customers. We really do want there to be there to provide them support." At least some of the library's new focus on housing insecurity is due to Wake County's efforts to address the affordable housing crisis. In 2018, the county formed the new Department of Housing Affordability and Community Engagement, which began working with Wake County staff, including librarians, to figure out new ways of helping people experience homelessness. In 2020, the library stopped charging overdue fees in an effort to limit barriers, says Burlingame. She wants to ensure people feel comfortable coming into libraries and they have unfettered access to books and other resources. In the past 2 years, the library's focus on affordable housing, healthcare access, and mental health has resulted in other new initiatives. Administrators started new partnerships with nonprofits and expanded existing education, public health, and child-focused programs. After all, helping people deal with homelessness isn't always about managing crisis situations. Johnson says you might see families with children who are living in a hotel but need a resource, a place that's away from a hotel, which is not necessarily conducive to a family. There might be a story hour to provide some sense of normalcy in a situation that can often feel chaotic. Still, one of the biggest superpowers of the library remains its ability to connect people with reliable information, says Burlingame. That can include information about employment, federal aid programs, or even legal services. Quote, "Libraries are really great places for the purposes of referral. So when someone comes into our libraries and they need help, we can connect them to rental assistance, government benefits, food resources." Today, Rob is just thankful for the internet access that the library provides. Surrounded by a smattering of half-empty plastic soda bottles, like sentries standing watch, he hunches over his cell phone as he participates in online surveys to earn a little cash. The money, he says, goes into his PayPal account, where he can use it for whatever he might need. He says, "We got food stamps, so it's something I can't get with food stamps. I'm just trying to get 70 more cents. Then I'll have $5. All right, 15 minutes left in this broadcast. This is to the town of Cary, which is partnering with Invicta Water to remove and destroy PFAS in drinking water. In a blue shipping container on the banks of Jordan Lake, foam fractionation units are being deployed in a pilot program that, if successful, could hold the key to cheaply and rapidly eliminating so-called forever chemicals from drinking water sources across the country. The technology from Invicta Water, a company founded in Burlington in 2023, combines the processes of removing PFAS from water and then separately destroying the chemicals on site. What are PFAS? They're per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. We'll explain that in a little while. But the PFAS, we'll call them PFAS. Invicta and the town of Cary embarked this week on a six-month-long pilot program that will see more than 18 million gallons of water drawn from the lake. That is one of the Triangle's, Jordan Lake, one of the Triangle's main drinking water sources, treated to remove PFAS, with the chemicals then destroyed. Following that process, the water will be added back to the water supply to be fully treated. Betsy Drake, The water utility engineering manager for the town of Cary says, "We're really looking forward to seeing what the results are. The fact that it destroys PFAS fast is very exciting, and so we're really excited to see what it can do." Now, PFAS, PFAS, are synthetic chemicals that have been used widely in the manufacturing of household products, including cookware, food packaging, carpeting, and waterproof clothing, since the 1940s. They're characteristically non-sticky and resistant to high and low temperatures and degradation, which makes them difficult to destroy. Because of their widespread use, PFAS have been identified in water, air, and soil worldwide. An estimated 98% of Americans have PFAS in their bloodstreams. But PFAS pose significant health risks and have been linked to a variety of ailments and conditions, including cancer, thyroid disease, liver damage, immune suppression, infertility, and developmental delays. In 2016, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, began regulating levels of three PFAS components, including Gen X, a toxic chemical found in waterways across eastern North Carolina that's linked to the Fayetteville Works site run by DuPont, now titled ChemWars. In the U.S., PFAS are present in almost 9,000 sites in almost 50 states, Washington, D.C., and four territories, according to newly released EPA data. The data confirm that 143 million people throughout the country use drinking water that has tested positive for PFAS. Dozens of communities in North Carolina, including Raleigh, Durham, Cary, and Chapel Hill, report PFAS contamination of drinking water above the EPA's limit. Last year, the agency required public water systems to complete monitoring for PFAS by 2027 and comply with its stringent limits on PFAS allowed in drinking water by 2029, work that is already underway in the Triangle. To rid drinking water sources of these chemicals, municipal governments are using a variety of treatment technologies. Cary, which has been testing for and treating water for PFAS since 2018, uses powdered activated carbon at its raw water pump station, according to Drake, who says it's been shown to be very effective at removing PFAS from the water. Our testing shows that our treated water is consistently below the proposed EPA limits. That method is costly, though, and removing PFAS only solves half the problem. The chemicals still needed to be disposed of, which is where Invicta Water comes in. Steve Wilkinski, the company's co-founder and CEO, says Invicta's process of removing and destroying PFAS came about in reverse. He and his team began experimenting 4 years ago with a proprietary material composed of boron nitride in a magnetic sort of process called adsorption. PFAS chemicals in water stick to the surface of the boron nitride crystals. Then, an ultraviolet light is shown onto the crystals, causing a catalytic reaction. The crystals function as a semiconductor and begin to emit electrons. Those electrons break up the PFAS and change the water in a way that also helps break the bonds, leaving behind no harmful byproducts. Wilczynski says, but destroying PFAS was only one piece. We had to figure out how to find it and remove it at the same time. What we like to think that we do is think about things a little bit differently. We're a small group of people. We don't have deep pockets. We try to do things ourselves. We wanted to find a better way than the status quo, and we didn't want to invent everything if we didn't have to. So they looked to foam fractionation, technology that's used in aquaculture, fish farms, large aquariums, and that uses water bubbles, air mixed with water, to bind to those broken up vase chemical molecules and pull those contaminants directly out of the water. We figured out a way to put a few of these fractionators together in a very special manner that we can find even in the smallest molecules. He says it's a process that's patent pending. Their final step was to build out the technology in a way that is scalable. They came up with a box that pipes in untreated water, runs through the system, separates clean water from fast contaminated water, which is now a smaller volume with a much higher concentration, and breaks those vase down. A version of this box will treat 100,000 gallons of water each day at Jordan Lake through September. Wolshinsky says, and all of this is done very, very little energy, a very small footprint, and it's very inexpensive compared to everything else that's out there. Invictus technology has two cost advantages, he explains, upfront costs and annual operation. While the most common vase removal technology that's currently in use, granular activated carbon, GAC, typically costs $2 to $4 per gallon of water. Invictus solution, $1 to $1.50 per gallon. For Carey's plant, which treats some 40 million gallons of water per day, that would mean a savings of between $40 and $100 million per gallon. Wolshinsky says the annual operation cost for GAC is about 5 to 10% of the upfront cost, or for Carey, around $4 to $8 million per year in perpetuity. At the highest end, Invictus' annual operation cost is about $800,000 per year. Over 10 years, the total cost of the technology comes out to about $48 million, while the total cost of GAC at the lowest end is $120 million. Additionally, PFAS are totally destroyed with Invictus method, while GAC requires hauling away waste for treatment off-site at an additional cost. Drake says Kerry officials found out about Invicta Water's technology at a virtual presentation that the city of Durham hosted. Drake says, we were intrigued by the technology and also liked the fact that it's homegrown, so to speak. Some of their key leadership lives in Kerry, so that was a cool thing for us. Along with Kerry, Invicta Water is conducting pilot programs with municipalities, manufacturers, and other customers across the Southeast, including the city of Burlington and Spartanburg and Lawrence counties in South Carolina. A recent pilot using drinking water from Pittsboro showed a 100% reduction in 3 vase compounds after treatment. Another pilot with the city of Raleigh showed a 100% reduction of 4 vase compounds in reverse osmosis-treated wastewater, and a pilot in Wake Forest using industrial wastewater showed 99.7% reduction in PFOA, forever chemical compound, and 100% reductions in 2 others. Wolshinsky says Invicta Water is also working on a project with a collaboratory at UNC Chapel Hill to show it can use its process to remediate ponds with extremely high levels of contamination, something that will be helpful for landowners who want to redevelop contaminated property. And the company is partnering with NC State and Duke universities, comparing lab results to see if the university's techniques can improve the accuracy, precision, and speed to get this data. That's also a big problem with PFAS, Wolshinsky says, just how long it takes to get the data. Soon, Invicta Water may be able to operate at both micro and macro scales, he says, treating millions of gallons of municipal drinking water each day, all the way down to having small systems operating in people's homes. The prototype for a home system is expected to launch this summer and could be a game changer for people living in communities that can't afford to treat their drinking water. Wilczynski says, we're going to have something that you can put in your house, probably. About the size of a water heater is what we envision. Those two will operate cheaply and efficiently. And he says, all we're really using is a little bit of electricity, air, water, and essentially gravity to do most of the work. There's almost no cost to do the destruction, and because we're completely destroying everything, there's also no waste to dispose of. I won't have time in the 2 minutes left to read this interview with Adam Sobzi, who is going to present a talk, I guess, on a book he's written, A Jewish Appendix with Rabbi Hannah Bender. And let's see, A Jewish Appendix, that's right. It's a poetic memoir, April 17th at 5:30 p.m. at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill. And in the time I have, I'll just begin this article. It says, the snow that fell on Durham last month postponed the Sobzi's reading at the Jewish Book Festival. That seemed oddly fitting for a writer whose new memoir, A Jewish Appendix, chronicles a series of detours and denied entries, both physical and the more elusive boundaries of Jewish identity. In A Jewish Appendix, he recounts a three-month journey through Europe that starts as a sort of speculative ancestry tour and evolves into something more profound. The book opens up with a coincidence. Hours after the 2018 Tree of Life synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh, he wakes up with acute stomach pain and has his appendix removed. 6 months later, while visiting Romania, his ancestral homeland, he's struck by a mysterious kaleidoscopic illness that disappears the day he leaves the country. The memoir weaves together these physical synchronicities with his internal identity reckoning. Though born to Jewish parents, Sobzi wasn't raised practicing Judaism. In one poignant scene, he sits in a synagogue while others chant in Hebrew, experiencing that as that type of dream in which everyone knows what's happening and what to do except you. Well, folks, we're at the end of our broadcast today, and John Fetterson will say so long to everybody, reminding you that this issue of Indie Week will be available as a podcast after this broadcast, and that you can also go to IndieWeek.com and hear more and read more excerpts and full articles. And so we hope you give that a chance, and we'll be with you next week for Indie Week. So long.